This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from the China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, longtime resident of China, and my hyperbole skills are astounding. My co-host is John Pass, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and thinks apathy is a growing problem and nobody seems to care. Comprehensible input is frequently used when talking about learning languages, but what exactly is it and what does it mean? John and I are going to break this down and give you a more nuanced view of the seemingly complex yet simple principle. Guest interview is with Emma Jaman, who found joy in learning Chinese and today teaches it in England. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming in from Utah here in the United States.
Hi everybody, I'm John Pasden. Spring is in the air here in Shanghai. Also large particulate matter from the Mongolian deserts. But anyway, hi everybody.
Well, sounds great. I'm back here in Utah. We're having an endless winter. It snowed last night again.
Bummer.
Yeah, we were at the record snowpack. It's like crazy. It's been like 800 inches or something in the mountains. Anyway, we'll survive. What is comprehensible input? This seems to be a question that circulates around the internet with a lot of different opinions and ideas about what that concept really is and how to use it to learn a language.
All right, so comprehensible input, it goes back to Stephen Krashen and his theory, the input hypothesis, about how we acquire language. So comprehensible input is a term. It means input you can comprehend. It's a comprehensible term, you might say, comprehensible input.
So the base theory behind Krashen, I like to say Krashen, whatever. All right, so the base theory behind Krashen's theory, So the core concept behind Krashen's comprehensible input theory is that we learn best at R level plus one. So he puts in a little formula. I represents our level. So I plus one is what we learn best at, and that's a comprehensible input. But there's always been a debate out there in the language learning world at really what is plus one.
And it's just meant to mean a little bit beyond your current level. How much beyond? Well, enough that you can handle it and keep learning. So it's not really fully defined because it varies from learner to learner.
That's right. And today, this is something that we wanted to talk about because recently there were some posts on Reddit in the language learning subreddit that talking about comprehensible input. Some people asking, is there any research? I made some other comments and posts about this and it sparked a big discussion. And really brought back to my attention how many different ideas and I guess in John and I might say, even misunderstandings at times about what comprehensible input is and the idea of comprehensible input versus the actual method, you would say, or the application of comprehensible input for language learning. So we're going to talk about this today, unpack it, and there's going to be a lot of, this is a very multifaceted topic.
Okay, so first of all, let's just acknowledge that comprehensible input, while the term might come from Krashen, is not really a new idea. Like anytime you're learning something, you start with the basics and then you just keep building on it, building a little bit beyond your current level, and that's how you learn, right? So, you know, some people would be like, comprehensible input, that's nothing new. Every textbook does that. Every teacher does that. You can't learn anything without this. And you know, that's true. As a concept, it is not really new.
Absolutely. We understand that and it makes sense. So back in the 70s, when Stephen Krashen published his work, his hypothesis on language learning, his comprehensible input hypothesis, it was actually made a real big impact in the language learning community.
Well, when it came out in the 70s, it was, you know, part of a discussion in the linguistic community. It wasn't until later that his ideas became more widespread that it really affected the average language learner. But it did eventually become quite popular. You know, his input hypothesis, his acquisition learning hypothesis, and what else? The effective filter hypothesis, the monitor hypothesis. So this set of hypotheses, it affected language teaching to quite a large extent. And it wasn't until lots of people began to really actively try to implement all these ideas that they started discovering some problems and And they came across a lot of questions they had. For example, Krashen was saying that you don't really need to learn grammar. You don't have to actively study it. It's all acquired subconsciously, whereas conscious learning is not really effective. So how do you actually teach then? Teachers that had 20 years in the classroom are being told that what they've been doing their whole lives doesn't work. So it created some waves.
As it definitely would. And we're still seeing these waves today, right? And this, to a degree, John, this almost feels like a little bit of what we oftentimes address, you know, maybe traditional language learning methods. And that's a pretty loaded term that can mean a lot of things. And we're not going to really go there today, I don't think. But, you know, there's a whole lot of implications of this.
So the way things developed was that teachers realized that they did need to provide comprehensible input. They wanted their learners to be able to understand, to be able to engage. But it wasn't easy to do without teaching a bunch of vocabulary and a bunch of grammar. So I think you could say that the theory, the hypothesis, it was put into practice in different ways in different places. And there was more of a focus on communication. People want to be able to understand, and then they want to be able to respond simply. But the actual, you know, abolishing of grammar and of, you know, just having a silent period, just like a child does, where you don't actually try to produce any output, you just keep taking it in very simple ways so that your subconscious mind can acquire it. All of that didn't happen right away, but eventually it did become more of like a method, which some people refer to as the comprehensible input method. And people try to use it as the full solution for language learning.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that really came out in some of these discussions. And I think let's go ahead, John, and jump into some of these concepts and even questions that people have posted.
So I think for some learners, it doesn't seem practical or perhaps not palatable to try to learn like a baby and to not try to talk. But for some learners, it's really appealing. And they really like this idea of being fed just tiny bits of language and learning it bit by bit, and also mixing it with stories. So there's an approach which really focuses on comprehensible input called TPRS, Teaching Proficiency Through Reading and Storytelling. And actually, we've had a guest on the show before, Diane Neubauer, and she's an expert in this. She also has her own website. We'll link to that in the show notes. But that's an example of a very passionate community which really focuses on comprehensible input, but they do it by bringing in stories because, you know, they recognize that adult learners, they need to engage intellectually a bit more than a baby who's just going to sit there and stare at you and let you speak to it for hours on end with no problem whatsoever.
To get a little bit of idea of what, you know, TPRS, what it looks like, you know, in the classroom, oftentimes, you know, the teacher, this is definitely something they need to be prepared and be a little bit, you know, trained to do. But it's like you get into a teaching environment with students, and oftentimes you might have a framework for like some sort of story, some basic story that the students can understand, that they'll understand mainly the vocab, and they get to participate in the telling or the creating of that story. For, you know, almost think of like a bit of a Mad Lib, you know, say, oh, well, we need some nouns, or, you know, let's give us a name or an animal, you know, okay, an elephant, great, you know, as we start telling a story with that, and you kind of continue to repeat and you build on the story. There's a lot of different methods, but there's a lot of this kind of repetition that happens in this TPRS method, especially at the low levels. And it can really be engaging, and there are a lot of students that really enjoy it, and a lot of teachers find it very effective.
And there are a lot of comprehension checks. So the teacher will repeatedly ask very simple questions to give the students a response to show that they are understanding. Even though it's simple, you know, they are following, and they can actually respond to simple questions.
So you're going to, and in this type of environment, you're going to get a lot of listening, right? But there's going to be a lot of opportunities for, you know, the learner to process, you know, comprehend what's being spoken or presented in whatever way, and also be able to create some sort of these responses, as John's mentioning, through comprehension checks and, you know, whatever's going on. But yeah, it's a very popular method right now. And like I said, a lot of teachers and students get some very good results from this.
So this is a method of comprehensible input that focuses largely on listening with maybe some speaking as well. Right. But then other forms of comprehensible input might be reading based.
That's right. That's where extensive reading comes into play. And in fact, this is one of the things that, you know, I mentioned there were some questions about this going on Reddit, that people were asking, is there any research behind the effectiveness of comprehensible input as a method? And a lot of people weren't so sure. And I'm like, yeah, there is extensive reading. And extensive reading is more of specifically the application of comprehensible input to reading. Now, the Extensive Reading Foundation, they're a great organization. I've gotten to know a number of the academics that are involved with that over the years. But specifically, their research in application of comprehensible input to reading has been influential, for sure, within the community. But when we go back to what we were talking earlier about Krashen's comprehensible input hypothesis, that we learn best at our level plus one, that debate has always been how much is plus one. Well, the research that's come out of the Extensive Reading Foundation has been able to determine that, you know, we learn best at a high level comprehension, specifically 98%. That's what they say their research shows, is that that's a sweet spot. And they have about 500 research studies and papers have been written over the last couple of decades, all leading to that core conclusion. Reading between a 90 to 98% level comprehension, they refer to this as an intensive reading. This is, you know, a little bit slower. You know, there's going to be a lot more new words in that. That's going to be maybe, you know, one new word in every like 10 to 20, 30. And then reading below 90% comprehension, reading pain. And we've all been there at some point. You know, you could take an hour going through a paragraph and not sure what you read by the time you're done. So, that's their study. So that has definitely been influential. It's definitely in the work that we've done at Manner Companion. It's great. It creates a bit more of a defined framework for what comprehensible input can mean.
So this all begs the question, how do you get to the level where you can handle extensive reading? Because the name itself, extensive reading, kind of suggests that you need to be able to read quite a few words, quite a few characters. And yeah, you do need to be able to acquire that somehow before you can start even at the Manner and Companion breakthrough level of 150 characters. And do you have to use the same comprehensible input method to get to that point? Well, no, actually you don't. And a lot of people, they use a more traditional approach. Most courses nowadays will incorporate some degree of comprehensible input. I mean, you can't really learn a language without it, right? But, you know, even classic textbooks will have simple dialogues, and they don't repeat and reinforce as much as a graded reader, but they do follow the I plus one concept and slowly, or sometimes quickly, introduce new words, new characters, and build your vocabulary and your character knowledge up to the point where you can handle a graded reader.
So I think, John, you mentioned begs the question. I think this also begs the question, all right? You know, textbooks, is it comprehensible, right? Is it comprehensible input? What is the difference then? Like, can I just learn a language just from my textbook? And if it's comprehensible, I understand it good enough, right? And if I can understand, you know, even if it's a bit hard, and I can understand at, you know, reading at a 90%, you know, reading pain level or lower, is that good enough, right? What's with all this comprehensible? Why do I really need to be reading high levels of comprehension? What's the difference between, you know, spending my time learning from a graded reader and reading one of those, or, you know, studying the textbook and studying grammar and all this type of stuff?
Okay, so what I'm kind of suggesting is that some people start with a more traditional approach, you know, learning vocabulary, learning grammar, taking it all in at a relatively rapid pace, and then eventually discover extensive reading, and then switch over to a more comprehensible input friendly approach, like that 98% sweet spot where you can be acquiring stuff fairly effortlessly. But what about the people that don't want to start that traditional way? They want to start with just pure comprehensible input. So we had the TPRS method that I mentioned earlier, but then there are also other methods, you know, using videos and stuff like that you can find online.
There are a lot of people that want to go out there and do this because comprehensible it definitely is effective, and it's a great way to approach it. One of the challenges in, you know, doing this from just, you know, from zero is finding materials, you know, finding content that is comprehensible to you. It is out there, but it can also vary, you know, in the quality. It can vary in the accessibility and also the interest level, right? For example, there are going to be some very basic stuff for, you know, toddlers to, you know, teach them Chinese, but that not might not be really jiving with you, right? But there's just a wide variety of stuff out there. But, you know, if you do want to jump into it from that angle, yeah, you do. But it's going to be work, of course, to go out and find all that stuff.
But keep in mind that it's not just study material. So yeah, you can have videos that use comprehensible input as the main focus. You can have reading materials, especially when you get to a higher level, that use extensive reading. But you can also find a teacher which really focuses on using these concepts to communicate with you and just repeating a lot, you know, just focusing on adding things little by little and doing frequent comprehension checks. This is, you know, similar to the TPRS training that teachers need in order to use that effectively. So some teachers do this more than other teachers. You know, some teachers might just give you 20 words in a vocabulary list and just have you read them over and over again and expect you to memorize them before the next lesson. So obviously that is not an application of this type of comprehensible input focused teaching.
Specifically to that point, and I'm glad you brought this up, John, is that, you know, even in some of these discussions that was happening on Reddit, someone was asking, well, hey, I'm learning Cantonese. Do you have any advice? You know, how can I use this for Cantonese? And someone chimed in saying, hey, you know, I actually have found a tutor on iTalki who is trained specifically in comprehensible input, you know, applying comprehensible input for language learning in Cantonese. And, you know, they went through the StarTalk programs in the United States, which is it's kind of a federally funded language learning stuff, and they do a lot of great workshops and stuff. And so they're out there. So, you know, you could go on, if you're looking for a tutor or a teacher in this area, you could go on iTalki and search for your target language and search for comprehensible input or TPRS. And it's quite likely that you're going to be able to find a teacher who is familiar with this approach to language learning.
Yeah, because whether it's videos or reading materials, if you're trying to read a story, you know, which is a graded reader, so it uses extensive reading, but you're not interested in the story, then it's going to be a horrible slog. And in the same way, if you're trying to watch a video that uses the comprehensible input concept and really repeats a lot, but it's not interesting to you, then it's going to be horrible as well. So it can be really nice to find a teacher who's trained in this stuff because they can help you focus on what you want to learn. And the thing about I+1 that's really great is that the plus one really can be anything. So I'm a big believer in personalization, and that's one way that you can get much more personalized with your comprehensible input.
Now, something I think is really important when we're talking about comprehensible input as well is that, hey, you know, we're talking about textbooks here. Hey, you know, hey, this stuff in the textbook, it, you know, should be comprehensible, right? Well, one of the things we're also kind of implied as well, and this is, goes a little bit more into extensive reading as well, but it's one of these things about not just having something that you can just comprehend, but also having enough of that content. So, you know, can you learn a language from studying a textbook? I mean, kind of, right? But you, even if you're, the textbook is really good at introducing language, but you're also going to need a lot of exposure to that language in a variety of contexts in order for that really to kind of sink into your brain. We call it, you know, acquire is what we would say, the language. And so while you may have some things that are comprehensible, it's also really important to make sure you're having enough comprehensible input for things to really start sticking in your mind. But I also want to, John, take one step further on this, because there are also some other, you know, I would say in my mind, a bit more extreme views on comprehensible input out there, as specifically implying that to language learning.
Ah, so Jared, you found some things in your research, right?
Oh, yeah, some from research. There we go. Well, here, I think what's good here, let's bring this up here. Specifically, there's this one method out there called Dreaming Spanish, and they have a website here, and let me just read this a little bit, John, and I want to get your take on this. What they're saying about comprehensible input: while speaking has its place, its importance has been grossly overstated. Speaking is output. That means when speaking, no new information is actually entering your brain. Therefore, speaking itself doesn't help us learn new words or grammar. In addition, at the beginner and intermediate levels, we still haven't acquired enough of the language to be able to speak well. That means our brain will try to find whatever it can to fill in the gaps, and that usually means using the vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation of your first language. After doing this repeatedly, we create connections between our first language and the language we're learning, which results in non-native use of the language that's very hard to fix. So, John, what was your take on this?
Yeah, I can understand it, but I'm not really on board with this. I think that speaking is also a big motivating factor. To be able to actually communicate with people motivates a lot of learners to continue to learn. Not only that, but as you acquire subconsciously various aspects of the language, such as vocabulary and grammar, you kind of think you understand it, but you're not sure how much you understand. And sure, you can keep listening and listening and gathering more and more evidence and internally, mentally testing your hypotheses. But another great way to test your hypotheses about what's correct and what's wrong is to just speak and find out if that sentence that you think is correct or not, because people will either understand you or they won't. So I understand where this is coming from, and I think it's closely related to the silent period, you know, where children just listen to adults around them and they're not trying to talk, they're just babbling, and they're just soaking it all in, and then eventually they actually try to start talking. I think this appeals to a very specific type of learner, and that's not really me, and it's not a lot of people I know.
Yeah, and also, you know, reading a little bit more about this, you know, some individuals saying that, you know, they're advocating, you know, not even trying to speak anything after, you know, at least 300 hours or 600 hours of input. I mean, if that's an hour a day, that's almost 2 years, you know, 1 to 2 years of input before you're actually trying to use the language. You know, like I said, in my mind too, that feels a little extreme. There's also people advocating as well for, you know, just no study grammar. Don't ever, you know, no, never. Now, I think, you know, John, we do see a little bit eye to eye on this one, where it's like studying grammar, it's a bit abstract when you sit down and try to study it, but it's helpful to as a check as you get along. There's some things you do need to have just a conceptual framework of how to approach it. Grammar is definitely patterns, and, you know, we by getting a lot of input, we start to recognize those patterns. But there's times where we, you know, having a bit of a check on that grammar, you know, looking into this and say, oh, okay, I understand now. This is how it works. But then using it, that helps us to really improve and learn our grammar a bit better.
Yeah, I think grammar works the best when you start to notice patterns and you're not sure if you're noticing them correctly, or you're definitely onto something, but you're confused by something else. And you could just keep collecting more and more data, you know, trying to figure it out yourself, but it can be a lot nicer to just check that cheat sheet, you know, the Chinese Grammar Wiki or whatever, to find out what the grammar rule actually is, or to find out that exception you keep hearing, yeah, it's an exception and it's the only exception. You know, stuff like that is really helpful. But Jared, getting back to your other point about is that super extreme, I actually am a little bit sympathetic to some of the people that have this view, because let's take into consideration the second language learners and the foreign language learners. Like, I learned Chinese well by coming to China, living in China, practicing Chinese every day. And for a lot of people out there, they can't do that. And for a lot of people out there, they can't practice Chinese with any native speakers unless they go online. And so this kind of comprehensible input focused, you know, input only focused method does kind of appeal to people in that situation, because they can just really soak it in. And I don't think it's wasted if you can stand doing all that input and waiting for the output, but it's just not something I'd personally want to do, which is why I came to China, right?
Yes, John, I also agree with that. And because, I mean, let's think about this. If you are, you know, get whatever target language you might be learning, if you ended up going into an environment where, you know, people are speaking that language, I mean, wouldn't you want to use it? You wouldn't, like, you know, say, you know, all right, I've been studying Chinese using only comprehensible input, and I'm only 450 hours in, and I'm in China now, but I'm not going to try to use anything I use. I'm not going to try to use anything I've learned here. You know, that doesn't sound...
That is impossible for Jared. He has to show off what he learned immediately. I can vouch for this.
But I think something that's really important is something that came across in a language conference I had went to a year or two ago, and this specifically was for dual language immersion programs in the United States. And we had a kind of a panel discussion among a few educators who were pioneers, really, in the dual language immersion here in the United States, starting some of the very original Spanish immersion programs in the 80s. And they talked specifically about some of this, is that, you know, hey, the focus really became on like, comprehensible input. And they implemented a lot of these things. And I recognize that they're about some of these things we're talking about, just having a lot of input. But they recognized, based on, you know, decades of their experience and other research that came out, that we need to not just focus only on comprehensible input, but also comprehensible output. And that when you combine both of those together, you get beyond these shy, as I put it, sometimes shy language speakers, where it's like, oh yeah, I've been studying for many years, but I can't speak, right? Ultimately, at the end of the day, we have to remember that language is a tool. It's something we're using to communicate, to connect with other people. And if we're not using any form of output, then is that really the tool that we need? Is that helping us really meet our goals? If all your goal is to just, you know, watch TV shows or listen, read news or articles and things like that, then maybe it is. But for the majority of people, it's not just a one-sided thing.
For sure. And Jared, actually getting back to that Dreaming Spanish website, I actually checked it out. I watched one of the videos because, you know, back in high school and in my early 20s, I was fairly fluent in Spanish. You know, I spent some time in Mexico, and I have not...
The F word, John, fluent.
What?
Oh, the F word, John, fluent.
Fairly fluent, FF. All right, but anyway, back then I was kind of fluent, but, you know, nowadays I never use Spanish, and I've been in China for quite a while. So I went on that website and I went straight to the elementary, sorry. So I went on that website and went straight to the intermediate videos and I started watching, and yeah, it was quite comprehensible. If I had just watched a regular Spanish language TV show, I wouldn't have been able to follow very well. But the intermediate level on that website was quite easy for me to follow. Maybe not the most interesting video for me, but it kind of appeals to me because I have already studied every single tense in Spanish. I've studied the subjunctive, you know, I once had a decent vocabulary. So I did not do the only input method, but now I can go to this resource and just get a lot more input than I ever had in high school or college because, you know, I wasn't focused on that back then. And it's pretty cool.
Well, that's great. So, hey, you know, it's one of these things. Hey, the content that's on there, comprehensible, doesn't necessarily need to have to follow exactly what their, you know, their approach to, you know, using the content.
Ah.
But there is a lot, some comprehensible input out
there. But here's the thing, Jared. I have two test subjects. My 11-year-old daughter has never really studied a foreign language. Like, I taught her a little bit of Japanese before we went to Japan, but she has expressed some interest in Spanish. So I was thinking it might be interesting to try some of these beginner videos on her and see how it works.
And
I haven't done it yet, but I will.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, this will be forthcoming in a future.
I will report back months in the future.
And bringing all this together, there was a lecture given by Paul Nation at one of the extensive reading world conferences a number of years ago. Now, Paul Nation, he's one of the leading academics in vocabulary acquisition, highly respected in the language learning community, and he's a huge advocate of extensive reading. And in this speech he gave, he talked about some of the research and, you know, we talk about the effectiveness of graded readers and extensive reading and comprehensible input and everything. But he asked the question saying, is that enough? Because what experience shows, and there are some studies, but there's not a lot of studies on this, is saying you take comprehensible input and extensive reading in our case as well, and you combine that with other approaches and other methods of output and input and a variety of types of activities in the individually or in the classroom, and we can come out with better language learning outcomes than if we're just focusing solely on this input aspect. And so what he's suggesting is that we need to widen our net, and there needs to be more research in showing that, yes, comprehensible input is one very important and critical key of the language learning process, but you combine it with other aspects of and other ways of language learning and output and communication, and you come up with a much more optimal and effective approach to learning a language.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of language teachers have intuitively understood for a while, and they've been working on different ways of doing this, and more research is needed. I think that's what Pollination is calling for. And it is happening. We don't have access to all that stuff, but language teachers around the world in all kinds of languages are all working on this. So I think in the future, we are going to get lots more interesting results from this.
Comprehensible input for the win. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is...
Mandarin Companion, Chinese graded readers. These are easy-to-read novels entirely in Chinese.
Today we're talking about Sherlock Holmes and Scandal in Shanghai. It's our newest Level 2 graded reader.
You may have heard of Sherlock Holmes and A Scandal in Bohemia. Well, this one is not in Bohemia. It is in Shanghai because it's not actually Sherlock. It is Gao Ming, our Chinese protagonist.
This was a lot of fun to pull together this book. We did a lot of research during the time period, and we found real-life historical characters that were in Shanghai at the time, including a Shanghai movie star. Scandalous!
No spoilers.
Not like, you know, bad scandals, but, you know, I guess what culturally scandalous, right, for the time?
It is a seriously scandalous PG story.
You can go out and get it. It's Sherlock Holmes and a Scandal in Shanghai, Level 2 Mandarin Companion Graded Reader, using only 450 basic characters. You can go out and get it on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, or wherever you get your books.
Let us know what you think. Okay, so this review is You Can Learn Chinese. It is by Ola Linga. And he says, this podcast combines realistic optimism about learning Mandarin, sound advice for both new and more experienced students, and glimpses of the different paths taken by learners to reach their goals. Even though I've been learning and teaching Chinese for a decade and a half, I still learn something new every episode. Thanks a lot, Ola. Ola is also the famous blogger behind Hacking Chinese. I've known him for a long time. You know, I've written Sinosplice for a long time, too, and we've had many correspondences over the years. So it's great to hear from him. He's also on another episode of this very podcast.
That's right, episode 48. It's How to Learn to Read Chinese, part 3 of 4. So, Ola's awesome. I tell you, I actually got to meet him once.
I think you did. Where was that?
It was in London. I was there for a language learning, Chinese language conference there in London in 2008. Yes, 2018 it was. And so he was there, and I was like, oh, Ola, finally, we're meeting face-to-face. So, yeah, he's a great guy.
He's a great guy. He did not leave that review just because he was on the podcast. He was on the podcast long ago, and he recently left this new review.
So, yeah, thanks, Ola. I appreciate it. And if you have a comment or a review for us, we would love to hear it. You can drop us an email or definitely give us a rating on iTunes. Drop us a note there. We'd love to hear from you.
And Ola has lots of great advice on hackingchinese.com.
All right, John, it's time for rants and raves. What do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
Okay, Jared, I have a rave. It's kind of a weird roundabout rave that's related to the genesis of this topic, because you know how you were having these Reddit conversations, and I was reading through the conversations, and someone brought up, I think it was you actually, that brought up click languages. And It reminded me of a conversation I had recently with my South African neighbors that I met in the Shanghai lockdown. I'd seen them around, but we'd never talked to each other. It wasn't until the lockdown that we actually, talked and became friends. And I was talking to them about click languages. So they're from South Africa, and they speak a language called, what we call Xhosa, but it's pronounced with a click. It's X-H-O-S-A.
And so, Xhosa, I don't know.
No, but see, that's not the click. So like,
I can't do it.
There are different clicks, and you're doing, I don't know what that one's called, but the lady in the YouTube video I watched, she calls it the horse riding click. Man, I can't do it. I totally forgot how to do it. All right, anyway.
Wow.
So she calls it the horse riding click, and she has a video about how to do it. And watching the video, I could actually learn how to do it. And it totally reminded me of the process of learning tone pairs. Because like when you first start learning Chinese, you learn the individual tones, but then when you try to pronounce them correctly in succession, it's super hard and you just keep getting it wrong. And you have to just keep trying. Mm-hmm. And so I was actually going to do the click sound because I learned how to do it. But now that I'm trying to do it, I've forgotten how to do it again. I have to go back and watch the video, just like I used to do with the tone pairs. So I guess my rave today is about lifelong learning and empathizing, because I think advanced learners often forget how hard it is to master, you know, the tone basics when you're starting out. But just trying to learn this click sound and combining it with a vowel brought it all back. So I can link to this video if you want to have that feeling again, because it's not comfortable, but it is kind of, I don't know, somehow enlightening. You can check it out because the video does a really good job and you can actually learn it. But yeah, it's still kind of frustrating.
No, that's cool, man. I honestly, these languages with clicks, Zulu is like one of them, right? Fascinating to me. I've heard someone speak that before, you know, that they spoke Zulu. And I'm like, seriously, I did the total thing. I said, say something in Zulu, right? But actually, I modified. I gave them something to say in Zulu and I just wanted to hear it. And it was like, cool. So.
Yeah, and so it's not hard to make just the click. The hard thing is to combine a click with a vowel. But anyway, all right, so Jared, do you have a rant or a rave for us today?
I have a rave, and this is a tool that I came across. I just thought this was really cool, kind of cool and interesting. So it's called Hanzi Graph. So Hanzi, so H-A-N-Z-I Graph. It's just hanzigraph.com. I'll put a link down there. But it's this cool little tool. This guy has just kind of made this open source thing. You can put any character or any word into it. And what it shows is like what are the most commonly characters paired with that character. It'll like, for example, you put wa in, you know, me, and it'll show you that I think the most common one is, you know, woman. Yeah, men is, you know, paired with it. Then it's like, I'm looking here. It's like,
what that?
Yeah, there you go. Duh. Actually, I think he takes duh out of it, okay. Because duh, yeah, is fair. Like,
you could say it's another word.
But it's like, wo kan. And then, you know, wo lai. And then wo zai. And then all these other things. So you can put any character in there. And it was just kind of interesting. You could see how it's paired. And it's kind of got this graph. It's got the character in the middle and has like these spokes coming out from it from the different ones. And then if you put a word in, then that one's connected to that. And has like colors to the spokes, you know, designate, you know, what level of frequency it's used with other ones. So I don't know how applicable is it. Actually, it's applicable for like AI stuff, right? Because you can see this is important for when, you know, AIs, they predict, really. They don't really like understand you. It's more they predict the text. But so I think that's maybe where some of this data is coming out of. You know, this might be using large language models. But I don't know. I just thought it was a pretty cool thing. And you can, it's just fun to kind of play around for people who are pretty.
Actually, though, Jared, if you go into Pleco, you can look up any character and go to words, and you can get that data from Pleco too.
But does it show the frequency of that word in connection with like?
It doesn't show the frequency, but it's supposed to be in frequency order with the most common ones at the top.
No, oh, I was unaware of that.
But it's not a cool spoke diagram like thing.
No, it's not. It's a list. You can create your own like, you know, molecular linguistic model or something with this Hanzi Graph thing.
All right, you have fun with that.
Hi, so I'm Emma Jamin. I am a teacher of Mandarin, Chinese, and French.
Emma joined me from her home in Leeds, England. We were connected by a longtime listener and fellow teacher of hers in the UK.
And I've been a teacher for 10 years, and I'm a mummy with two children, who I'm bringing up bilingually with my French husband.
Learning Chinese opened up Emma's life in such a way that it became a conduit for her to inspire children to believe in themselves and achieve more than they had dreamed. Stay with us. Okay, Emma, why did you start learning Chinese?
So I was 19 and I was living in my little bedsit in Nottingham, stacking shelves in Asda. I did have good A-levels. Can I just say I did do well in my A-levels, but I had rent to pay.
No, just real quick, those who are not familiar, the A-levels, these are like college entrance exams, is that right?
Yeah, it's higher education. So once you've finished your compulsory education, you can choose to go to college, sixth form. So I did my A-levels in sixth form, yeah. But I did well there academically. But financial circumstances just meant that I had to fund myself and I was living on my own in a little tiny bedsit in Nottingham. So I had to work and I was stacking shelves in Asda, working night shifts, as you do. It was very boring, actually. But I was saving up to go to uni. And I was going to be a psychologist. I wanted to do psychology at the University of Nottingham. But I took one of those old student gap year guides, Jared, from STA Travel, an old kind of student travel agency company. I had a look in there and I thought, I want to just run away. I want to go to the other side of the world as far away as I can and just have a new experience. You know, I can't stand this stacking shelves forever whilst I'm waiting to go to uni. So don't ask me why. It was a 50-50 choice between India and China. Don't ask mm-hmm. me why I ended up picking China. It was
well, why? I'm going to ask you why now.
Well, those were the two options. It was teaching English in China, or I think it was working in an orphanage in India. And in the end, I picked China. I didn't know anything about China. I'd never studied Chinese at all. And, you know, I like to speak. I like talking a lot. So I would never have gone to the other side of the world and not be able to communicate with anybody. That would have been too scary. So I signed up for just community evening classes at the University of Nottingham, just beginner's classes in Mandarin. And I really liked it. I got into it. And it just meant that when I did go and teach English in Shandong province in China, it just meant that I could actually start to communicate a little bit with people and just really make the most out of that experience. It was the first time I'd ever really traveled properly.
Well, tell me first, though, about this community class. Was this led by a professor? Was this like, you know, some Chinese people, let's get together and try to teach Chinese to people?
It was just one of these extracurricular classes that were run. I think it must have been a student teaching or one of the teachers. I don't know. I can't remember, to be honest. It was only an hour a week. Just the basics, the real basics. I remember starting to learn pinyin. It was just for communication.
Well, that's great. And how long did you have to study before you actually went overseas?
I only did it for a few months, maybe 3-4 months, like one semester.
Gotcha. Well, that's great. So it just gave you, I guess, some element of familiarity, perhaps, right, before you actually went overseas.
Yeah, it was just like if you're going to France on holiday, a lot of people take holiday crash course in holiday French, don't they? That kind of thing. It was that, really. It was just so that I could communicate and feel a little bit more confident going to the other side of the world on my own.
Now, tell me about that experience, though. Your 19-year-old girl going to China.
Oh, it was fantastic. Oh, man, it was amazing. It was completely different to anything I'd ever experienced in my life. The people were so friendly, so welcoming, and oh, the weather was beautiful. It was Yantai in Shandong province, a beautiful city. Mm-hmm. The food was fantastic. It was lovely. Yeah, teaching English, I only did it very briefly. It was like a month and a half or something like that.
Oh.
Just to primary school kids. But as soon as I walked into the room as their teacher, there were about 70 kids in one classroom.
Wow.
And they would stand up and they would cheer. They were so excited to learn. It was lovely. You know, and I was obviously teaching English, but it was an even more enriching experience for me because I was able to also communicate a little bit in Mandarin as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this was just a very kind of preliminary experience. I'd only just started to put my toe into the water there.
It's always a journey and it starts somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But you were only there, you said, for like a month and a half before you came back? Or
something like that, yeah. Yeah, like I say, I was only 19. So that was my first taste of another culture and learning another language and just realizing how different, how amazing other parts of the world were that I'd never experienced before. It just opened my eyes to another world.
Yeah, I can understand that. And how did this propel you forward? Okay, because, I mean, there are a lot of people who maybe take a gap year or might go teach English in China for even a short period of time. But how did this propel you forward in saying, okay, I want to really learn the language?
I became really interested in what I was doing, and I fell in love with the country. I fell in love with China and the Chinese people and the culture. And I decided, hey, I don't want to really be a psychologist anymore. I'm going to scrap that. And I cancelled my degree course in psychology, and I applied for a completely new course at the University of Leeds instead. I applied for the ab initio degree course in Mandarin, and I actually got onto it. I couldn't believe it. So I had a second gap year. I went to work in Jersey, and that's where I met my current husband.
Uh-huh.
In Jersey, and started to learn French being with him. So it all kind of snowballed, and I started to slowly become a bit of a linguist.
Like, hey, you know, you went to China, you came back, and you're like, hey, psychology? Nah, I want to study Chinese now. What kind of reaction did you have from maybe friends or family when you made that decision?
I think it was something that caught people's interest. There's nothing wrong with studying psychology. I'm still fascinated by it, the psychology of education and all that. But I'm from a council estate in Nottingham. And when you talk to people in your family or your friendship groups, and you say that you're learning Mandarin, that's not really common.
Mm.
I don't mean to generalize, but it's kind of true. You don't really get those opportunities very often. So yeah, I think that motivated me a lot. The reaction that I got from my friends, from my colleagues, from my family members, what, you're learning Mandarin Chinese? What, isn't that the hardest language in the world, or one of the hardest languages in the world to learn? That's crazy. Go on then, can you write it? What can you say? What can you write? Yeah, it just caught people's interest, and I liked that. I started to feel like that was becoming a part of my identity. You know, oh, Emma, yeah, she can speak a bit of Chinese. Oh, she went to China.
But you decided to go on and learn. And something I'm kind of interested in hearing about from your experience here is kind of understanding, what was that experience like studying in a university atmosphere? And maybe even contrasting that, fast forward a little bit, based on what your understanding is now and some of your experiences on, like, maybe what some ways to improve, or like people can learn better, specifically Chinese.
Yeah, so if we fast forward, my second year of the degree course was spent in Shoudu Shifan Dashui, which is a capital normal university in mm-hmm. the Haidian district of Beijing. Oh, it was fantastic. And it was just before the Olympics as well. The Olympics were being held in Beijing in 2008. So we went at the most exciting time.
You know, we might have been there at the same time. I was there like 2 months before the Olympics.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so we were there as well. Yeah, we were there at the same time. Haidian district was great. I would say that I kind of realized that I'd made a breakthrough when I realized that, hey, I'm living a real Chinese lifestyle here. So it wasn't just a case of, yeah, I'm studying abroad, I'm learning in university, and then going back and hanging out with all my English friends. My friends, my own friendship group, we made a real conscious effort to really integrate into society and to make lifelong friends with the native Chinese speakers around us. One of my best friends and I, we randomly went up to the noodle lady. We called her the noodle lady. You know how you get these food hawker kind of streets?
Yeah, yeah.
She was always selling noodles on the corner of the street. They were our favorite noodles. The food was delicious. We used to go and buy food from her all the time. And then one day, I remember my friend, she said, oh, hey, let's go and ask if we can help her. She can show us how to do it. So we just used our spoken Mandarin skills to just make friends and to take risks and to have new experiences in the country with the locals. So we helped Noodle Lady to serve noodles to people.
That's
one
awesome.
Afternoon. That was really good fun.
I bet her business went pretty well that day.
Yeah, she got some funny looks that day. I'm not sure how good the noodles tasted that day. Sorry, everybody. But yeah, made by a Weiguaren. Also, I decided to go and get myself a little part-time job around my studies. So I don't even know if it's still there. This was a long time ago. But there was a really, really lovely luxury hotel next to the university campus where we were. So I went there one day and just asked them, obviously in Chinese, have you got any jobs? Can I have some work experience? Is there any work that you could give me here? And they were delighted to give me that opportunity. I didn't get paid. It was voluntary. I didn't do that for the money.
Kind of like an unpaid internship, right?
Yeah. It was just, they liked to have a Wygoren on their door welcoming people. And again, that just kind of drew attention to their lobby as well, with a white girl there with a Chinese uniform on.
That sounds like a pretty cool experience. I mean, did you actually get to use your Chinese a lot, or were people trying to speak English to you, or what?
A lot. Some of the guests did come and try and speak English to me, yeah, but whenever I replied to them in Chinese, they were really impressed, and they would ask, what am I doing there? Why am I working there? You know,
where are you from? Why are you here? Are you married? You know, all that.
Yeah. But that was a really fantastic opportunity. And I saw where the receptionists in that hotel were living, because they were living in staff quarters on site.
Oh, yeah,
that was interesting. About 8 of them in one room and a shared bathroom. So I got to see behind the scenes what it was like for those quite young receptionists who worked there and lived there on site as well. I'm not sure whether I was allowed to actually be in there or not. I don't think I was actually, but it was really interesting. I was disguised as one of them in the hotel uniform. So
for me, and I know for many others too, you know, sometimes pulling back that curtain, you know, and seeing how, you know, local people, if you will, you know, lived in certain conditions, it was quite eye-opening and impactful.
Oh, absolutely. Another really good friend that I made on my year abroad in Beijing is a lady called Eileen Fang, or Chu Fang is her Chinese name. She was my Mandarin teacher, but I was a little bit older than my classmates, and she was quite young for a university teacher, because it was more like a classroom than a lecture theatre. Yeah, we became really good friends. We went shopping together. We went to her house. We met her husband. She came over to ours and we made her English breakfast. And we had a great friendship, great time together. And actually, Jared, she's living in Singapore now, and I've just come back from Singapore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just went to Kuala Lumpur and I nicked over to Singapore whilst I was on that side of the world.
Oh, wow.
And I went to stay with her for a couple of days, and her family as well. She's got a little girl the same age as my little girl.
Oh, that's adorable.
We've made lifelong friendships there. That's changed my world, because now, you know, look, it's the Easter holidays. I fancy jetting off to Singapore. And I've got some Chinese friends living in Singapore. I'm able to go and stay with them, speak Chinese to them, and be immersed in it for a week or for a few days. It opens more doors and I feel like a global citizen. I'm not that little girl stuck in a council estate speaking English.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to know about, what was that path and that decision for you to saying, all right, okay, this is interesting. I'm enjoying learning Chinese and I'm obviously improving at this point, to I want to teach Chinese. I want to be a teacher.
I think I always wanted to be a teacher deep down. And I thought that I was really interested in psychology. I really enjoyed psychology A level, and that involved the psychology of education. That's what interested me when I was doing my A levels. And so I think I always deep down knew that I was going to end up as either a teacher or an educational psychologist, something like that. But then naturally, once I'd started to gradually become a linguist by mistake, by accident, yeah, it just kind of opened my world up so much. I wanted to give that opportunity to other people. And I didn't want to just give those opportunities to people who already had a lot of opportunities offered to them. So I've always actively sought out schools and institutions where I could have the maximum impact on those students' lives. So I do see that with what we're doing now, Jared, honestly. I have been over to see my friend, as I've just said, in Singapore. She works in one of the top international schools in the world as a Mandarin teacher. And I've seen what she does. I've seen her resources. She's told me all about the facilities and the opportunities that are given to the students in the school she works in. And I'm comparing that with what my team and I are offering to our students in our trust in England. And actually, it's exactly the same.
Oh, wow.
And that's just made me feel so proud that we are allowing our students to be on a level playing field with those students in her class in one of the top international schools in the world. What we are offering our kids, Jared, is exactly the same opportunity. It just puts them on par with those students and allows them to compete with the best in the world. That makes me feel really proud.
That's fantastic. So maybe you could also give us a better idea of what Chinese language education is like in the UK, maybe in your area. And I know you're part of a Chinese language organization there as well. Maybe you just talk about that a little bit.
I think it's really hard to generalize because we all have our own different styles, even within our trust. You know, there's how many people are in my team? Eight of us. We all have completely different teaching styles, and that's fine. We're encouraged to experiment. We're still in a stage where we are trying out different strategies, different approaches. For example, some of us are really into the Gianfranco Conti style of teaching, using sentence builders, chunking grids. That's fantastic. My thing is I like writing raps. So I find out which songs or raps the kids are interested in at a given time. Mm-hmm. And then I search out the instrumental version. And then I compose my own lyrics in Mandarin.
Nice.
And the content is the content of the curriculum map. It's what they would need to learn in order to succeed in their speaking tests. And instead of just rote learning a text for one of their tests, they learn a Mando rap and then they go home and I don't even have to set speaking homework. They just do it because they go home with their mates and start rapping together.
Wow.
And it becomes quite competitive. And yeah, we have a great time doing that.
The rapping Chinese teacher, I like it.
I think we've got the first Mando rapping class. I don't know if I can claim that or not.
Probably someone else out there has done it or doing it
But that's, yeah, but not like us.
But not like that. No, of course not. Not like that. Cool. That's really neat. What are some of the biggest challenges that you find in teaching Chinese?
I would say some of the biggest challenges when learning Chinese, I think it's actually overcoming barriers in terms of belief and people's perceptions as to who can and should learn Chinese. I'm so passionate about this. I really think that Mandarin is for everybody. It's accessible for everyone and anyone can learn Chinese. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what kind of background you're from. It doesn't matter what kind of family you're from. It doesn't matter what kind of, if you've got any special educational needs or preferences. In our trust, we teach Mandarin Chinese to those students who are in alternative provision. We make it accessible to everybody. And we do that by being really creative. I like to use lots of therapeutic strategies, multi-sensory ways of teaching Chinese, using Play-Doh and pipe cleaners, and we use chalk pens on the walls and on the tables and write Chinese graffiti. Yes, it sounds a bit naughty, but the kids love it. So we have quite a lot of students who are privileged, but we also have a real high number of students who are from difficult backgrounds in terms of socioeconomics and can be considered disadvantaged in that sense. And it can be quite difficult to motivate those students sometimes if we're not teaching them in a creative, engaging way. They're not always looking that far ahead to the future. They're not always thinking about what job they want to do or what they want to study at university. Some of them are still in survival mode, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's about motivating those children who are in front of us now by making our teaching engaging and fun, making them want to buy into it.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, I know like in America, in Chinese language education, in, you know, primary education, it generally trends to higher socioeconomic status, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I know other teachers and other people involved in like Spanish dual immersion and Spanish classes. And it's kind of interesting because their socioeconomic background of their students is typically lower in comparison to those in Chinese language programs. So it sounds like there's maybe some similar types of dynamics there. And so it sounds interesting how you're trying to address that. But I'm curious to know also, why do you feel some of that is there in your culture and your society?
Mandarin Chinese is so often considered as a really difficult, really challenging subject, and it's still predominantly taught to the top set kids in the leafy green suburbs. I still believe that's the case in the UK. There are still not that many schools in the north of England that offer Mandarin on the mainstream timetable.
Hmm.
Certainly not for alternative provision or for all students in such an inclusive way like we're doing it. We offer Mandarin Chinese to everybody. It is possible. You just have to be more creative in your teaching style. You've got to be experimental and see what works and be adaptive.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm also curious to know, have you had any, I guess, success stories or individuals where, hey, you know, Chinese actually made a real impact on them?
So there's one girl, she was in an alternative provision last year, the alternative provision which belongs to our trust, and I was teaching her Mandarin there. She really, really absolutely loved learning Mandarin, and I think that it was a fantastic hook. It helped her to re-engage in mainstream education. She told me that she wanted to carry on with Mandarin, and when she came back to the mainstream academy, she started learning Mandarin Chinese with me here in one of the mainstream academies, and she's doing really well. This is a student that someone might have perhaps written off, but I think that we've been able to use Mandarin as a hook and a way to reintegrate students in many cases. It's nice to be able to use languages as a way of reintegrating those students into mainstream.
Wow, it sounds like it's a way that can reach certain students, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting how people respond to a variety of ways and things, you know, and how we can potentially connect and reach with them. But it sounds like that's maybe one of these ways that it's be able to connect with certain students.
Absolutely. And I think what often happens, like in my own personal experience, Jared, I think in a lot of cases, the students, they might go home and say, oh, you know, I'm learning French, I'm learning Spanish. Yeah, the parents, they've probably been traumatized by their own educational experiences of learning foreign languages in the past. And, you know, we've had Brexit. Oh, well, Brexit, what do you want to learn foreign languages for? What do you want? But when the kids go home and say that they're learning Mandarin, it's something really different. It makes them stand out, and it captures the attention of their parents and their grandparents and their communities. So I think that can be really motivating. And China is the here and now, but it's the future. And there's so many connotations with business and wealth and development that I think you can't ignore that. No matter where you're from, it's obvious that you need to learn Mandarin to get by in the future, to get a good job.
So Emma, it sounds like you've worked with a lot of students who've overcome a lot of challenges to learn Chinese. And what are some of those challenges that you faced in your life and you've overcome to continue to get to the point to where you are now?
Yeah, I did. I did have a lot of challenges. And most of those were socioeconomic challenges, really. I remember being at university. When I first arrived, I cried my eyes out. I hated it. I just felt like I didn't belong there. I shouldn't be there. It wasn't for me. What is this world? Everybody's from private schools and they're all posh compared to me, and I'm not going to succeed. But then I did just as well and better than some of my classmates. So I was proud of myself for that. I overcame that kind of inferiority complex, I guess. And then I remember once when I couldn't pay my rent. I was working as well at the weekend, but I already had accumulated debts by then. So I remember once I couldn't pay my rent and I called my mom and I said, Mom, I can't pay my rent. I'm going to have to quit uni. What am I going to do? I can't afford to live. And she said, well, you'll have to quit then. You have to come home then. I can't do anything. I nearly did. And then I thought, no, I can't quit now. I can't. I've got to find another way. But then I went to the university accommodation office and found out that there were grants available. Obviously, they didn't shout about these things because everybody would ask for them. So they helped me out a lot there.
Wow.
There's always a way. Nobody should ever feel like learning Mandarin is not for them. They should never, ever let a challenge stop them. They should just persevere and keep going and find a solution. And in my penultimate year, I lost my dad as well. My dad was an alcoholic.
Oh.
I want other people to know that it's not always easy, but learning Chinese can change your life and it can be a passport to a better future, a better life. When he passed away, I nearly didn't get there actually in time. I was in the library studying for an exam and I knew deep down he was going to be gone soon. And one of my best friends, Steph, she was saying to me, Emma, go, for goodness sake, just stop it. Just get on the train and go. You're going to miss him. You're not going to get there in time. So I'm really grateful for that. I think in many ways, I've used studying and working to block out things sometimes instead of dealing with them. And in that situation, I think I did that then as well. So yeah, I'm not a finished article at all.
Who is?
I remember I had to deliver a speech at my dad's funeral in front of lots of people. And I think it's the first time I'd ever done public speaking ever in front of so many people in a church.
Under difficult circumstances.
Under difficult circumstances and not knowing whether what I was saying was right, the right thing that everybody wanted to hear or not. And I think for a little while after that period, I went through a stage where I just find it quite difficult to speak sometimes.
What got you through that time?
This sounds really strange, but I have a theory that sometimes when you can't find your voice, when you learn other languages, you have other voices, if that makes sense.
It does.
Sometimes it's easier to talk about your feelings in another language. It's like you develop an alter ego. I don't know if there's some kind of scientific theory.
There is. We actually talked about this in our very last episode about, yes, about it. There's studies about this.
I'd love to explore that because I really think that it's a way of being able to express yourself in another language. Sometimes it's easier. It's like you're not hearing your own voice. And it's easier to speak about things in a different language than in your mother tongue.
I shared a story of a German lady who was a Holocaust survivor. And she came to America later on and she won an Oscar for a documentary she made about the Holocaust. And she was able to talk about her very traumatic experiences in English. Whereas German, it was very difficult for her to do so.
Seriously? Is that...
Yeah.
Really?
That's an anecdotal, but there's a lot of other research.
Wow. I'd love to explore that.
So that's interesting to hear that Chinese sounds like it was a little bit therapeutic for you, help you find your voice.
Absolutely. And in other ways as well, just sometimes when I needed to de-stress, I would get the calligraphy brush and the magic paper out and just put some calming Chinese music on. And I find that really relaxing and therapeutic. And writing the characters out can be quite cathartic. The repetitive nature of it and the way that you just get lost in it, I think it can have really strong, impactful therapeutic properties. I do, honestly. And so what we're offering, I feel like I'm not just teaching them Mandarin to be able to get a good job. Yes, it's a passport to a better future. It's a way out of sometimes really difficult lives, offering them a chance to improve their lives, a way out. But also more than that, a way to connect with their emotions, to express themselves.
Yeah. So Emma, I really appreciate all this. What kind of advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
I would say, if you are interested in Chinese, if you want to go to China, just do it. Just do it. Don't let anybody put you off. Don't let financial situations stop you. There is always a solution. There's always going to be somebody or some kind of organization somewhere that will help you. There are students in the trust that I work for who I know cannot afford to go on a trip to China. But there are ways and means, without going into detail, the school is able to help them to go. And I know that some of those students are still going. Lots of people might avoid doing a degree in Chinese. They might think it's totally out of their league. It's not even accessible to them. Chinese is accessible to everybody and nobody should be put off doing it for any reason at all, whether it's confidence or what other people say, what other people think, whether it's finances. just do it. Just don't be put off. Don't feel inferior. Doesn't matter where you're from. Doesn't matter what needs you've got, what learning style you've got. You'll get something from it. There's so much that learning Chinese can offer everybody. So I just think everybody should have the chance to do it.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate you sharing that perspective. And also, Emma, like, thanks for sharing your story and your advice. It was just really touching and heartwarming as well. I thanks for taking the time.
That's okay. Thanks. Yeah, that's just part of it. It's long.
All right.
Yeah. We'll go. Thanks, Jared.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, meteorologists, sculptor, agent, soldier, coach, arborist, and that one guy named Ramsey. Please subscribe to our podcast and share it with a friend. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. You can also reach out to us at mannercompanion.com or mannercompanion on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or even TikTok. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo, and interview editor is Dominic Edgley. I'd like to thank our special guest, Emma Jaman. And of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasty. See you next time.